I'm your host, Reverend Al Sharpton. Let me go right to the live line. I'm honored to have as our guest this morning and this afternoon for you on the West Coast. He has done the show when he was president. He's on now as a former president, but always be my president, and a great author, Barack Obama. How you doing, Mr. President?
I'm good. How you doing, Reverend?
I'm doing very well. Let me get right into it. I am a bibliophile. I read a lot. But I must say, in reading this book, this is one of the most inspirational and, I would say, substantive books I've ever read. One of the things that is very important is in the middle of this pandemic, you talk about what you did to get the Affordable Care Act. You walk us through. We're right on the front row watching it. Share with us the reason you wanted to go through that detail and the importance that that act that you passed with a lot of work and the work of your team, what it really meant to the American people.
Well, listen, I appreciate you taking the time to read it, man. And, you know, the goal of the book was to tell a story. Hopefully to inspire young people to get into public service, whether it's in government or nonprofit or activism, to understand their voices matter. But part of it was also to get all of us to understand a little better how our government works. Because I think so often, as you know, we have this sense that, all right, once we elect a president, whether it's Barack Obama or Joe Biden, that's the end of the story, and now we expect them to just get, stuff done, we don't have anything else to worry about. And part of what I wanted to really communicate is that the president has power, but the president, in order to accomplish big things like getting health care done, they've got to have a Congress. And even once you have Democrats in control of Congress, there's this thing called the filibuster in the Senate, which can block up votes. And you've got drug companies and insurance companies that are lobbying and trying to block stuff. And so, you know, the stakes are high and the pushback is fierce on any progressive legislation. And that's why it's so important for citizens to be involved and understand what's going on, because as I tell in the book, part of the reason we were able to get this thing done was not only did we have people like Nancy Pelosi as Speaker and Harry Reid, who was the leader of the Senate because people had voted, but we also had continuing ongoing support from everybody, from folks like you, Reverend Al, to nuns like Sister Carol, who I write about, who were willing to stand up and say this is something that needed to get done. And that kind of activism on the part of ordinary citizens is going to be necessary in order for us to fix some of the problems that we still have today.
And you having a background of being a community organizer, you had a real understanding of the need of that. And I think part of the, I would say you wouldn't, but I would say genius of your administration is you brought those rare views to the Oval Office, where you kind of understood activists and nonprofits and clergy, as well as you understood government, which most people don't have that kind of understanding in elective office.
Well, I think it certainly helped, right? That sensibility is something that I always tried to bring to the work because, you know, the thing that I understood when I became president was that I might have a vision for where I want to take the country, but I can't do it by myself. And part of the reason in the book, is, as you know, is I spend a lot of time describing all the staff, some of whom aren't famous, right? So on healthcare, you've got Nancy Ann DeParle, who, you know, she's a working mom, got two kids. I mean, she spent a year just day in, day out fighting to make this thing happen. I try to portray some of the young members of Congress who had just gotten elected, and they came from conservative districts. And they knew that if they voted for the Affordable Care Act, because these were predominantly Republican districts, they'd probably lose their seat, but they did it anyway. And that kind of sense of collective effort, that it's not just one guy or one woman, that I think is the essence of our democracy when it's working the way it should. And I hope that's something that we remember. Obviously, when we saw all the activism of young people this summer with Black Lives Matter in the wake of George Floyd's murder, it was an indicator that this next generation understands the need to participate. And that's part of what's made me optimistic, even when government was mismanaging so much.
The fact that you also faced this economic recession when you came in, I don't think people understood how close we were to a brink of almost a depression, or if not in fact a depression. And you kind of walked us through how you walked that back. I mean, we were really in trouble.
It was serious. And part of the reason I spent a lot of time telling the story of what we did to stop the economic freefall we were going through is because people have forgotten, in some ways, because we did a pretty good job saving the economy. But with all the steps we took, we still lost a lot of jobs and folks lost their homes. And so people didn't feel good. The economy didn't snap back right away. I think people never had a clear sense of how close we were to a much bigger disaster. And that's a good lesson for us to understand today. Joe Biden's going to be coming in at a time where the economy is still weighed down by this pandemic, even though we have hopefully a vaccine coming next year. You think about all the folks who've lost their jobs, the restaurants and small businesses that have closed. The recovery is going to require government to step in even more than it already has. And you can already hear Republicans trying to run the same game they ran when I was president, where suddenly, once a Democrat's in office, they start worrying about deficits and why are we spending money providing poor folks and small businesses relief when they were happy to spend $1 trillion on tax cuts or eliminating taxes for big corporations. And that kind of bait and switch, I think, is something that Joe Biden's going to confront. And I want voters to be paying attention when that happens, because the truth is that we are going to need the kind of bold government steps and relief and programs that can help lift folks up from the bottom, not just help folks at the top.
One of the things in terms of lifting people at the bottom, I think it became clear to a lot of people in the pandemic how important the Affordable Care Act was, for example, because now we're going to have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people with pre-existing conditions, which right. You really took care of in the Affordable Care Act. And many of us are going to keep the pressure on to make sure the Supreme Court doesn't reverse it, because people that maybe didn't understand the impact of it long term understand it now in the middle of a pandemic. We really need this. This is bedrock. I was stunned a little. Stunned may be a heavy word, but I was surprised when you said you were more joyful the night that you passed the Affordable Care Act than even the night that you helped to preside over the capturing of Osama bin Laden.
Well, look, you know, the book ends with the operation to get bin Laden. And as I describe, I could not have been prouder of how folks operated up and down the chain of command, right? I mean, you had the Navy SEALs, you had the intelligence officers, you had folks like Bill McCraven, who was the head of special forces, I described, you know, great American and somebody with a lot of integrity. And so that operation was hugely complicated and important to keep America safe because it's helped to dismantle Al-Qaeda. But you know what? For me, at least, the reason I got into government, the reason I ran for office, was more than anything to help folks and heal folks and feed folks and give them jobs and purpose. You know, that's the stuff, the positive stuff that inspires, right? The stuff you need to do to defend yourself against folks who are trying to harm America, that's a critical part of the job. But what I felt the night we passed healthcare was, all right, this is what makes the sacrifice worthwhile. Because as you said, Reverend, the legacy of that lasts for generations. You know, I always viewed the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as, it's like the starter home of a major social program. It's not perfect. It's not everything we want, but it got that foundation in the ground. It gave over 100 million people protection when it comes to pre-existing conditions, gave over 20 million people health care that didn't have it before. And now, hopefully, with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and others, we can build off of that to get to the point where we truly have universal coverage. But if you don't get started, if you don't lay that foundation, then that bigger goal never arrives. And so, I was proud of that. As I write in the book, you know, that was one of the rare times where I went ahead and had a drink midweek. Usually I was a teetotaler during the week, but that one I figured I'd earned a little bit of celebration.
All right, let's take a break. I'm coming back. I want to ask some personal questions to our President Barack Obama. Yeah. Mr. Obama, you took a lot of heat from different quarters, including the black community. I remember I got into it with some of my friends publicly because people said, is he doing enough for blacks? And I thought that the big picture that you were doing absolutely helped blacks. What would you say fortified you that made you strong enough to take even friendly fire, and you seem never to lose your cool? I mean, you used to cool me down sometime because I just felt things were unfair. What fortifies you?
You know, I mean, part of it is just confidence in the facts, right? You take the black community, right? And as you said, there are times where activists would say, man, you know, what are you doing specifically for us? And I knew the data. I knew that during my presidency, black poverty went down to its lowest level since 1968. Income's up. Business is up. Graduation rates up. Incarceration rates down. Juveniles being detained down 30%, teen pregnancy down. So I could just look at what we were doing, and it was working. And that, I think, when you feel as if all right, I've done a good job, even if I haven't gotten everything done that I want. And I know how hard it is for us to get even a little bit done. You know, it doesn't mean that I wouldn't cuss once in a while when folks were saying something. But I knew that when all was said and done, I had run a good race. I'd done what I could do on behalf of my people and on behalf of all people. And then part of it is you know, you and I, we've talked about this, and I think this is part of anybody who has faith and you know engages in prayer. You know, one of the powerful things about religious belief is you take the long view. You know, you understand that you're going to, any given day, you're going to have your ups and downs. The polls may be up, the polls may be down. Folks may, you know, bear false witness against you. They may make some stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have confidence that in the end, when the final accounting is done, if you've done right as well as you can, if you've followed a path that you feel, you know, reflects integrity and purpose, that, you know, that's all you can do, you know, and I always felt that I was pretty good about not getting stuck in the day-to-day, you know, reading the headlines and worrying about, you know, whatever, you know, mess arrived in my inbox on that day. You know, and you know, Michelle always says that's just temperament. She's, you know, she thinks because I grew up in Hawaii that I'm more chill. That might have something to do with it too.
Well, I also was always awed by the fact you always looked at the bigger picture. And when Joe Lowry, early in when you were running, said to me, look, Al, we've got to go with him, the bigger picture. And as long as you look at the bigger picture, you can take care of the things in between. And you were challenged throughout the 8 years I had access to the administration, was in a lot of the meetings. You always would raise our sights to the bigger picture. Where did you get that from? Were you always like that?
You know, I some of it's learned. I think we all grow, and part of the reason in this book that I go into detail about how I was feeling, mistakes I was making, doubts that I was having, is to kind of track my own development from the time I was a community organizer to a state legislator to a U.S. senator to president, and part of that process, Al, is to kind of empty yourself of some of the vanity that is involved in public life, and you and I have both experienced this. It's what Dr. King called the drum major instinct. Right. We all want to lead the parade.
Right.
And when we're young, I think a lot of us, when we get into public service, you know, that first time we make a speech in front of a big crowd and get everybody fired up, you know, that first time that, you know, we're getting a lot of attention in the press or on television, you know, it is natural. It is human nature to say, OK, wow, this is terrific. I've made it. I'm on the stage, right? As time passes, and I describe this process, you know, you start realizing that those are kind of empty calories, right? That if that's what you're living for, if you're chasing this based on your own ego, that you're always going to be chasing, and you're never going to settle down and refocus on what's most important, which is the work. And I had to, like everybody, I think I had to learn that. But by the time I get to the presidency, I sort of realized, you know what, you've had enough attention. You know, you've been on the cover of magazines. You've been praised. You've been a drum major. And so now your real focus should be, what are you accomplishing? And I think that was a healthy step that I was able to take. But, you know, I try to emphasize in the book, it's not one that happened immediately.
Let me ask you last question. Why did you name this A Promised Land? What was the reason you chose to title it that?
Well, we all remember Dr. King's speech right before he was killed. Yeah, I may not get there with you, but I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the Promised Land. The biblical roots of so much of Black culture and American culture, that the idea of Exodus and escaping from bondage and wandering, you know, that dovetails with a major theme of this book, which is America doesn't start off delivering on its promise to everyone. And, you know, for generations, you have struggle and marches and activism and setbacks and disappointment in order to perfect this union, to make it more perfect, to make it more inclusive, to make sure that workers have representation and African Americans have full citizenship in the vote and women have equal status. And those fights, those battles, resulted in America getting better. But it's still not where it could be. And I thought that, if there's one thing I want folks to take from the book, particularly young people, is to understand that just because we don't arrive at the promised land, the perfect union, doesn't mean that the journey we take can't get us closer to that promised land. And maybe it's going to be our children or our grandchildren who finally arrive because of the work that we did. And, you know, in a year where we lost a dear friend of both of ours, John Lewis, and C.T. Vivian, and, you know, so many of the giants who helped pave the way for us. I wanted to communicate in this book the fact that it's our turn, and now you're starting to see Malia and Sasha's generation coming behind us, and the struggle's never finished, but there's nobility and satisfaction and meaningful change that results from that struggle. And that's what this book's about.
It's a great book and everyone should have it for the holiday. Let me say this to you in concluding, and I thank you for this time, that the one thing that I want to give, I have my first grandchild and we'll give him Marcus Al. You went to do the funeral for Nelson Mandela. I couldn't go. You invited some of us that were and still are leading civil rights groups. But you brought back and you gave a program to me that you autographed to Reverend Sharpton, a fellow warrior for justice. That is the most prized possession I have. I'll never be able to thank you for that from Barack Obama. Barack Obama, author of A Promised Land and one of the transformational presidents in United States history. Thank you for being with us, Mr. President.
I appreciate you, man. You and your family have a great holiday. Stay safe. We got some more work to do before this pandemic is clear.
Yes, sir. Same to you and your family.
Appreciate you.
Appreciate you.